This is a panel we probably should have done sometime during the 4 years I was co-chair, and we didn't do it. So wanted to be sure I wrapped up all the loose ends and have helped with this one. So why Viacom VU2 matters besides the $1 billion? Now, I know feelings run strong, and we're not here to enact an appellate argument. We're going to discuss the possible legal and business ramifications of a decision either way. And we are fortunate to have an all-star panel. Daniel Blackman, who is a co-founder of Howcast, and before co-founding that company, worked at Google, as he said, spending every waking hour convincing big media companies to put their content online, is one of our speakers. Unfortunately, Dan Hart woke up this morning feeling quite under the weather and sends his regrets that he can't join us today. Michael Kwan, however, has flown all the way from California to be here. Thank you very much, Michael, who is counsel at Kuecker and Van Nest and submitted in the district court proceeding a amicus brief on behalf of a number of parties in support of YouTube. Cliff Sloan has traveled from D.C. He's a partner in litigation at Skadden Arps and also filed amicus briefs in the case in support of Viacom in this case. And Thomas Sidner is a senior fellow and director of the Center for the Study of Digital Property at the Progress and Freedom Foundation, and he's here with us today. And, of course, our moderator, James Grimmelman, who's an associate professor at New York Law School and one of our really wonderful, distinguished moderators here. So without further ado, gentlemen.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Let me just say a bit about our order of business on the panel today. I'm going to start with a very short slide presentation on the legal background of the case and the central points of the court's holding. And then I will give you to our speakers for about 10 minutes each, at the end of which we should have a fair amount of time for your questions. So, without further ado, let me summarize as quickly as I can the basic DMCA questions the case addressed. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act's limitation of liability for service providers in 512C, one of the immunities there, says that service providers are not liable for monetary relief and copyright infringement by reason of the storage at the direction of a user of material that resides on a system or network controlled or operated by or for the service provider. So it provides a shield to copyright liability, provided that these service providers comply with a number of conditions. And some of these conditions were at the center of the litigation before the district court. They're spelled out. I'll list three of them that were quite relevant here. First, requires that this provider not have actual knowledge that the material or an activity using the material on the system is infringing. There's a knowledge-based exception, which has some parallels to the common law doctrine of contributory infringement. And I've highlighted in bold some of the phrases that played particular roles in the court's reasoning. So the provider not have actual knowledge, or in the absence of such knowledge, is not aware of facts or circumstances from which infringing activity is apparent. Courts and some commentators have given that prong the name red flag knowledge. Or upon obtaining such knowledge or awareness, acts expeditiously to remove or disable access to the material. The second limitation is that the provider may not receive a financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing activity in a case when the service provider has the right and ability to control such activity. And third is the famous 512C notification and takedown procedure, that upon being given a notice in a specified form, the provider removes access to the material or loses its immunity under the statute and faces the regular lawsuit for copyright infringement. And while that takedown procedure has been the subject of great controversy and a number of lawsuits, it was not directly at issue here in the Viacom versus YouTube decision. Instead, the court focused on whether YouTube could qualify for the safe harbor at all. So, YouTube, everyone I'm sure is quite familiar with it, enormous video sharing file site. Users upload some 24 hours of video per minute. Actually, since I prepared these slides last week, they've announced that number is actually now up to 35 hours of freshly uploaded video every minute. YouTube takes the files, reformats them into some common web formats, then makes them available for viewing by other users. You go to the URL, and you can see a streaming version of that video clip. And YouTube, whenever it receives a notice of infringement, removes the video, disables access to it, tells the uploader that you've received a complaint. It does not, however, affirmatively look for videos that are infringing. If a user receives three such strikes, notices of claimed infringement, YouTube terminates their account. And for purposes of the summary judgment motion, the court decided, the court accepted that YouTube was, in a general sense, aware of the fact that there were infringing videos on the site and welcomed them. So the court's holding on those facts focused on a distinction it made between specific and general knowledge of infringement. So it construed the statute to require that the defendant have specific knowledge of identifiable infringements of particular individual items. Mere knowledge of prevalence of such activity in general is not enough. So it found that YouTube had that general form of knowledge, but not the specific, and therefore was not, could not be liable and satisfy the safe harbor's conditions. It supported this with extensive quotation from legislative history, which focused on the large volume of works and the difficulty of sorting through them. It also cited the previous copyright cases and one trademark case on the specific versus general distinction in the context of online service providers. In a subsidiary holding, it declined Viacom's suggestion to apply the Supreme Court's decision on inducing infringement from MGM versus Grokster. The way that the court analyzed it, Grokster addressed the general doctrine of contributory liability, but the DMCA, as a statute, controlled. So that, therefore, Grokster does not apply to a service provider who merely furnishes a platform. Finally, the court addressed a few other points quite briefly, each in a page or less. The plaintiffs raised an argument that YouTube does more than just provide storage. The court instead held that the definition of a service provider also applies to what the court termed collateral transmission, routing, or providing of connections, and operation of facilities. So the reformatting of the videos, for example, was permissible. And the plaintiffs also raised an argument under the financial benefit plus liability control test, the one that parallels common law vicarious liability. And the court said that right and ability to control should also be interpreted as requiring actual specific knowledge rather than merely general knowledge. So that's the basics of the decision. And now let me turn you over to our speakers, the first of whom will be Tom Sidner from the Progress and Freedom Foundation.
Okay. I'm Tom Sidner, and the Viacom versus YouTube litigation has a number of legal issues in it. Trying to think about how we might get through them in the time allowed, and one way was to sort of split them up. So I'm going to kind of kick it off by sort of discussing what I hope will in the long run turn out to be one of the least interesting issues in the case, and that's what are the implications of the fact that this is an inducement case. The principal claim that Viacom focuses on in its moving papers is a claim for intentional inducement under Grokster, focused mainly but not entirely on the conduct of the original founders of YouTube. That they essentially, the argument is that they intended to, did, and took actions to effectuate, intent to basically use piracy to build up their business, and then, as one put it, sell out. So what implications of that arise as a result of the fact that there is a very serious inducement claim being made in this piece of litigation? Well, one, I think many of us, and me included, I have been telling people for years that the odds of this case, it would be important if it did produce a reported decision, but the odds of it doing so were very slim because big cases like this tend to settle. This one didn't. Why? I think one answer has to do with the nature of inducement liability. So it's been around for a long time. It appears quite clearly as a basis for contributory liability for copyright infringement in the Second Circuit's famous Gershwin case. But before Grokster comes along, the doctrine is really essentially moribund. Nobody brings inducement claims. Nobody litigates them. As for why that would be, the answer is simply causation. If you look at some of the pre-Grokster case law, to establish an inducement claim, you would have had to have basically established a causal connection between the inducing act complained of and particular acts of infringement. Very difficult to make that prove that causal connection, particularly if you're talking about a widely used product or service. And in Grokster, what the Supreme Court does is it fixes this causation problem and fairly dramatically. By concluding that, you know, if you intend for your product or service to be used, for people to use your product or service to infringe, then the culpable act's not merely just encouraging infringement, but distributing the tool intended for infringement. In other words, you can be liable for all the infringing use. This is a very, you know, that means an inducement claim is capable of generating liability that is significant to absolutely any company. And it's important to note that in the Grokster case, the Supreme Court makes this change in the law very deliberately. It understands perfectly well, I think, that this change in the law was really a financial death sentence for the distributors of Grokster and Morpheus. So what's the evidence of inducement in YouTube? Well, for an inducement claim under Grokster, you've got to have two basic elements. Intent to induce infringing use of your product or service, and affirmative acts made to effectuate that intent. As far as what those affirmative acts might be, the record actually exposes a number of them. YouTube ends up disabling community flag, establishes community flagging for an infringement, and then quickly disables it because it's starting to work too well. It carefully calculates which classes of infringing work should be taken down in order to, you know, create some facade of respect for copyrights while perpetuating other forms of mass infringement. Created groups to attract users to infringing videos. And you can, in addition, also one of the things I found particularly interesting, YouTube employees also conducted surveys of the most popular videos on their site to see how many contained copyrighted content, concluded that 70% did and left them up. The other thing that's interesting in all this is that most of these documents actually surface, not from YouTube, but from one of the original founders who happens to have just retained a lot of records from his time at YouTube, a lot of electronic text messages and emails. And as a result of that, I mean, the failure to preserve, the failure on the part of YouTube to preserve other evidence, I don't think is inculpatory at all. But the fact that this one sort of stash of emails happens to appear does mean that it might be possible for a jury to infer that these are actually just examples of wider problem of conduct. The evidence, though, that I found perhaps most interesting is related to one of the original YouTube founders, a guy named Stephen Chen. And I think this shows pretty clearly what the real problem with inducement really is. I mean, when Chen understands his own, that he might be on the line for copyright infringement, he knows perfectly well that's a problem. He needs to make it stop. When he thinks that the only people who are in danger of being on the wrong end of a copyright infringement lawsuit are the consumers who use his service. He leaves it up. That is the sort of conduct that I believe Grokster is intended to prevent. But we get a new ruling in YouTube. The interesting thing, I thought the case, by the way, by the parties was extremely well litigated. And one of the interesting things about the ruling is it actually decides the case in a way that's barely argued at all below by the parties. And the judge says, well, yeah, the jury could find the defense were actually welcomed a copyright infringement jailer on YouTube, and then tries to basically do a few things. Number one, tries to distinguish cases like Grokster, Fung, and Line Group because they involve peer-to-peer file-sharing networks, which the court says can't qualify for safe harbor provisions. That's simply wrong as a matter of law. There is no reason they can't. They generally don't, but there's absolutely no reason they couldn't qualify under 512C or 512D. Then it makes the comment that Professor Grimmelman mentioned. Basically says, well, you know, maybe you did, they did engage in the type of conduct that Grokster prescribes, intentional inducement of mass piracy, but that's okay. The safe harbor protects that. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, I actually think Justice Kennedy, and during oral argument in Grokster, hits it right on the head when he says to their counsel, well, what you want to do is say that unlawfully appropriated party can be used by the owner of the instrumentality as part of the startup capital for his product. That captures what's a problem that I think needs to be resolved. How do you resolve it? Do the 512 safe harbors actually create a safe harbor for intentional inducement of mass piracy? Would Grokster have avoided liability if it had simply responded to takedown notices? And I think the answer is no. The statute dates from 1998. Doesn't explicitly, expressly in the text address the question of whether intentional inducement is a grounds for losing your safe harbor protections. Nevertheless, I think if you step back and look at that provision in context with other relevant legal provisions, you see pretty quickly that it is most implausible to believe, most difficult to conclude that the 512C safe harbor could ever protect an entity, a website operator engaged in intentional inducement of mass piracy. Number one, the biggest problem, I think the one that was ultimately dispositive in Grokster, and you have the same problem occurring here, you're talking about creating a safe harbor for civil liability for conduct that would be criminal, potentially, under existing law, if you could prove it under the requisite burden of proof. So, inducement liability is often called the civil analog of criminal aiding and abetting. So, by the time you're engaged in intentional inducement of mass piracy, you could be potentially criminally liable for aiding and abetting copyright infringement. Big problem, even bigger problem, you could also be liable under RICO. If you intentionally induce piracy, potential crime. Intentionally induce mass piracy, you're potentially a racketeering enterprise. And the interesting thing about this is that Congress actually declares a criminal copyright act infringement to be a predicate act of racketeering in 96, Clinton and Congress do. 1997, they expand the definition of criminal copyright piracy. And so why in 1988 would the same president and Congress create a civil safe harbor for the conduct they just criminalized? Makes no sense. Worst of all, intentional inducement has a nasty cousin called a duping scheme. There are two ways to induce somebody to break the law. You encourage them to break the law deliberately. You trick them, or you can trick them into breaking the law unintentionally. We have certainly seen evidence that has occurred in the world of internet piracy and with horrific societal consequences. I've written extensively about that. I'm not going to drag into the details. But to think that duping, which is a form of intentional inducement, could be protected by the 512C safe harbor is most improbable. Then, of course, there are the international implications of all this. If we need to stay in compliance with our obligations under TRIPS, that means any exceptions or limitations to copyright protection have to conform to the three-step test. I think the safe harbors, as I understand them, do. However, we also have to criminalize copyright piracy on a commercial scale, and I think if it turns out we've created a safe harbor for that on the civil side, I suspect we're in violation, we might have transcended the bounds of the three-step test. So how do you avoid it? So if there are policy reasons not to conclude that Judge Stanton's decision on this point is simply wrong, what's the textual basis for doing so? Well, there are really two. One, the type of acts that trigger inducement liability aren't acts by a third party, and they don't involve something as benign as storing material at the direction of a user. They're affirmative acts by the inducer designed to effectuate an intent to induce. Those are simply not the types of acts that enjoy any protection under the safe harbors. There is no strain between Rockster the harbors, in other words. They just don't overlap. The other way, I think, is one that I hope that maybe Clifford Sloan could talk about a little bit more, and that's to simply look at the language in dealing with actual and constructive knowledge, realize that those are legal terms of art. They have very well-defined meanings, and if you give them, if you assume that they are intended to have retain their ordinary meanings when used in ordinary legal meanings when used in this statute, they really resolve the problem of intentional inducement altogether. Obviously, if you intend something, you have actual knowledge of it and constructive knowledge as well. So I think that is the other, that to me is maybe the most important textual basis for concluding that the 512C does not protect intentional inducement of piracy. Thank you.
And next, as just advertised, Cliff Sloan.
Thank you, and thank you to the Copyright Society for hosting this discussion of this important case. And it is a very important case because the core issue in the case, which is of enormous legal and practical significance, is whether you can have a business model based on stolen content to attract a large audience, and that's perfectly permissible and appropriate and a smart business strategy, as long as you do one thing and one thing only, and that is take down material that you get in a DMCA compliant notice. And as long as you do that, you're home free. And as Tom was mentioning, Justice Kennedy's question in the Grokster argument puts it perfectly. Whether stolen content can be the startup capital for a business venture, as long as you take down the specific material in a DMC notice. Otherwise, you can encourage it in the district court's euphemistic saying, welcome copyright infringing video. You can build a business on it, flip it for $1.8 billion, and that's okay as long as you have responded to the DMCA compliant notices. Now, I want to elaborate on what Tom was saying about the abundant evidence in this record that is exactly what was going on, that is not hyperbole. And remember, this case was decided on summary judgment. And the district court's decision was this shouldn't even go to a jury to evaluate the evidence. And I want to elaborate on that evidence in a minute. But I want to just start by framing with a couple of the major legal errors in the district court opinion, some of which have been alluded to by Tom. And one of them is the basic statutory language and structure. And Professor Grimmelman put it up. And I would actually, quite frankly, approach it differently from the way Tom did. Tom talked about all the problems and maybe the policy concerns. And then he said, well, is there language that gets us out of this box? I would do it exactly the other way. As a matter of statutory construction, let's look at the language and the structure of the DMCA. And it is absolutely clear that, yes, there is notice and takedown in the statute, but there is also a requirement of actual knowledge and red flags. And the district court opinion eliminates actual knowledge and red flags as independent requirements. It collapses them into notice and takedown. Notice and takedown is all that matters. And, of course, under basic principles of plain language, of statutory structure and construction, you don't just make two provisions redundant. Now, as a matter of statutory purpose, of course, there's a very clear reason why there were two additional requirements, because in the extensive legislative history, Congress was really concerned about piracy, about rampant copyright infringement. And so it was having notice and comment and, in addition, actual knowledge and red flags. But the language and the structure, I think, could not be more clear that those are separate and independent requirements in addition to notice and takedown, and that you're doing violence to basic principles of statutory construction by eliminating them as independent requirements. And briefly, the district court does exactly the same thing on the right and ability to control provision. As Professor Grimmelman noted, the reason that doesn't apply is because, according to the district court, right and ability to control, you have to have the same kind of specific knowledge from notice and takedown. So the district court opinion also collapses right and ability to control. Now, I think that is wrong as a matter of statutory construction. I also think the consequences are quite alarming when you look at what it really means, that you can have a business model based on stolen content. And Tom briefly had some of the emails that are in the record up on the screen, but I want to take a moment to read briefly from six separate emails, and these are just excerpts that are in the record. Okay, and remember, this was at the summary judgment stage. Here's one. A YouTube founder objected to the removal of, quote, obviously copyright-infringing stuff by noting that 80% of YouTube's user traffic depended on infringing videos. And he emphasized that, quote, if you remove the potential copyright infringements, site traffic and virality will drop to maybe 20% of what it is. Okay, second email. The same YouTube founder responded to a concern about, quote, stealing movies by saying, we need to attract traffic. The only reason why our traffic surged was due to a video of this type. Third email. Another YouTube founder exhorted his colleagues to, quote, concentrate all of our efforts in building up our numbers as aggressively as we can through whatever tactics, however evil. Okay, now the Grokster decision comes down. Tom was talking about it. And this causes some concern at YouTube. You know, do we have a problem here? Because look at what this does with inducement law. And so they come up with a plan in which some infringing clips are going to be taken down, but many are not. And they send an email that says this: that way, the perception is that we are concerned about this type of material and we're actively monitoring it. But the actual removal of this content will be in varying degrees. That way, you can find truckloads of copyrighted content if you are actively searching for it. Okay, fifth email. One YouTube founder noted that another founder was, quote, blatantly stealing content from other sites and trying to get everyone to see it. All right, in the last email that I'll quote, and there are more in the record, and these are laid out in the briefs, a YouTube senior official emailed a colleague that, quote, the truth of the matter is probably 75 to 80% of our views come from copyrighted material. Remember the earlier email about 80% from copyrighted material. And the same senior official noted that, quote, the fact that I started like five YouTube groups based on copyrighted material probably isn't so great. Okay. Now, I think this is pretty powerful evidence, and I think at a minimum, this should have gone to, it clearly should go to a jury. But the idea that evidence of this type does not qualify as actual knowledge or red flags confirms that under the district court's opinion, the actual flags provision and the red flags provision have absolutely no independent meaning, and that they have basically been written out of the statute. And I think that that is a very serious error of statutory construction, and I think it is an error that, if upheld by the Second Circuit, I think casts a very big shadow over the future of digital content online, because it immunizes business models based on stolen content. Now, I think that the statute, the statutory language and structure, is sufficiently clear that I would say I'm very optimistic about Viacom's chances in the Second Circuit, because I think, again, if you just take a plain language approach to the statute and giving independent meaning to each of the provisions, I don't think the district court opinion can stand.
Thank you. And next we will hear from Michael Kwan from Kuchen Van Nest.
So I'm going to try to avoid actually making this into the appellate argument that we were at the beginning. We said that this was not going to be. But so I'm going to take a slightly different approach to this. But suffice it to say, I disagree with a lot of that, as you'll see in a moment. But I do think, you know, it's absolutely true that there's three separate provisions there. And what I think that Judge Stanton was saying is that the requisite knowledge, actual knowledge, and the requisite awareness for the red flag provision have to be of specific items rather than of general knowledge. He didn't say that they had to come specifically from notices that came from the copyright owner. He didn't say anything about that. What he did was he addressed the evidence that was before him. But I'll get into that a little more in a second. So as some of you may know, I was actually at Google in-house when the lawsuit was filed, and I was there for the first year of the litigation, so I was privy to a lot of the details. And then I left Google, and all sorts of interesting things happened behind the scenes. Depositions were happening. I didn't get to know all those details. And when the summary judgment briefs got filed, personally, it was very interesting to finally find out what had happened in the previous 2 years. So a lot of those juicy details that I think a lot of the people here in the room have been very interested in were very interesting to me, just from that perspective. And I think that a lot of people are wondering why is it that Judge Stanton didn't get into all of those juicy details. And I think that there's, from my perspective, it seems like he did two things that made it unnecessary for him to go into those things. First of all, what happened in the 3 years between the filing of the lawsuit and the summary judgment motions? So those are 3 years of hard-fought discovery between two very large companies, well, also the class action, but between some very large companies. And it took a long time, 3 years. In that time, we had a lot of decisions that came down in this very area. We had, I think, three decisions about VO. We had the Perfect 10 v. CC Bill case about red flag awareness out of the Ninth Circuit. We also, not in the copyright area, but it's Judge Stanton referenced it, we had the Tiffany v. eBay case, which actually came out while briefing of the summary judgment motions was going on. So, first of all, I think that by the time he was penning that opinion, he felt that this was no longer the cutting-edge issue that it once was, and that actually there had been a lot of decisions and there had not been a lot of disagreement. If you look at those decisions, they all go the same way on all the points. So I think, first of all, he felt that this was now, even if these were not binding precedent, this was well-covered ground and perhaps didn't require as much of an extensive opinion, and he could rely on the work of his fellow judges. So that's the first point. But the second thing is I think that, you know, instead of starting with the facts and seeing where they led him, he took the approach that most judges take, which is he looked at the law, he looked at the relevant law, and he tried to figure out what facts he needed to be aware of. If he was able to decide the case without getting to other facts, there was no need for him to go into those. And I do think that, you know, there was these juicy details that I referred to several times. You know, there was a lot of interesting stuff on both sides. There was some of the points you've already heard. There was also a lot of discussion in the in YouTube's papers discussing the fact that there were all sorts of extensive efforts by Viacom to get videos up on the site through accounts that looked very much like these were viral postings by individual users. There were people who were heading out to Kinko's to make sure that if somebody looked at the IP address, this wouldn't look unusual. They were doctoring the video, or talking about doctoring videos to make sure that they looked rough cut, like somebody had taken the video off of the filmed it off of a screen, or that they had added. They were saying, maybe we should add some sort of a timestamp on there so it'll look like somebody pulled this in off of a satellite feed that was going to a local station. So there was a lot of things that I think raise a lot of questions about exactly what the YouTube people could have known when they looked at these videos and what they could have known about whether or not these videos were authorized. And those details, I think, if you get into them, are a lot more fuzzy than has been suggested. But ultimately, when we're looking at 512C, I think we have to remember what it is. It's a safe harbor provision. The entire point of a safe harbor provision is to take an area of law that is potentially very messy and create some relatively bright-line rules that people can guide their conduct by. And what the plaintiffs in these cases would have you believe is that what you need to do is you need to go through all the same analysis as you would have to without the safe harbors. And the whole point of safe harbors is to avoid exactly that sort of messy analysis. And so I think it just can't be that the safe harbors have the meaning that Viacom would suggest that they have. And if we're going to talk about the structure of these of 512C, you have some things that are plainly general requirements that don't go to specific clips. You are required, if you want to take advantage of the safe harbor, to identify an agent for copyright notices, for takedown notices. So that's, you don't do that, you lose the safe harbor, period. So that's an obvious general requirement. You have to have a repeat infringer policy that you reasonably implement. So there's disagreements in the case over what exactly is a reasonable infringer policy, but nonetheless, that's pretty clear also, that the repeat infringer policy is something that goes to your entire site. What you have here with the three provisions we have up on the screen are these are all qualifications to the actual safe harbor. So that these other things that I mentioned, these are the repeat infringer policy, having an agent, DMCA agent, those are things you have to do before you can walk in the door to look at the safe harbor. But then the safe harbor comes around and it says you have immunity. And by the way, it says you have immunity from monetary liability. It doesn't say actually that you're not a copyright infringer. So if there were some issues of criminal liability that hinged on whether or not you engaged in infringement, jail term or something like that, it's about monetary liability. So it's a little different than what we heard before. But if you look at it, these three provisions, it says you have this immunity unless these so long as you do these things. And all of these things are things that I think are much more comfortably read as being, as Judge Stanton read them, relevant to specific video clips. The notion that, first of all, so you actual knowledge that, actual knowledge, or let's just take them together, actual knowledge or red flag awareness. It cannot be that the mere fact that you are aware that someone out there somewhere is infringing copyright is going to mean that you generally do not have the safe harbor at all. Because that would apply pretty much to everyone that the safe harbor was intended to cover. If you think about 1998 when they were enacting this, they were thinking about web hosting companies primarily. So if you think about web hosting companies and you think about somebody who's providing services to thousands and thousands of different sites, they know statistically to a near certainty that they're going to have someone out there who is infringing copyright. They have awareness that they are providing a service such that it's going to be true that somebody is infringing copyright. If that meant that they lost the safe harbor for all of the websites, that would be there would be no safe harbor. So there was, at a practical matter, be no safe harbor. So what we get from that is that if you think about what they were trying to accomplish, the only way this makes sense is if indeed the safe harbor, the question is, do you have actual knowledge of the very infringement that you are accused of liability for? Do you have red flag awareness of that? Of that infringement. It's not a generalized infringement in the air sort of issue. And if you look at the actual language, you have things like you have immunity for, blah, blah, blah. And then it says, unless you have knowledge that the material is infringing. It's talking about the material for which you were trying to gain the safe harbor. So, it's talking specifically. Or if you look at what you need to do if you do have awareness or you do have actual knowledge, if upon attaining such knowledge or awareness, you act expeditiously to disable the material. Again, it's talking about the material for which you are trying to get the safe harbor. All of these things have to be done on a case-by-case basis, and I think that's pretty clear from the structure of this. So, that's the not quite appellate argument side of this. But I think that perhaps the more interesting question is, what are we going to do? What is everyone out there going to do if indeed YouTube is right and this is the law? The question is, are we going to be able to work things out? Is there going to be some disaster? And I think that the answer there is pretty clearly no. And if you look at Viacom's moving papers, Viacom gave up on any sort of case once YouTube had established its content identification system. And YouTube spent a ton of money developing this system. And if you look at the moving papers, it's not because YouTube's moving papers. It's not because YouTube said, look, we have this content identification system, therefore we're not liable. That's irrelevant to whether or not YouTube is liable. They developed that system because YouTube has a vested business interest in working with the content side of the world. So I think that the business incentives worked very well to come out with a solution that works out quite fine for everyone, so that what you really have here is a discussion or a legal battle over past issues. And you know, I think that if you look at the Tiffany case, you know, there's also it's a similar sort of question. People have said, well, what's going to happen here? Well, if you look at eBay spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to develop a system to work with people to identify infringements and to take those down. And again, you know, eBay has a vested interest in making sure that it doesn't have a system that is where people, when they're buying things, think, oh my God, I'm going to get copyrighted goods. There's or counterfeit goods, I should say. So, I mean, I think that the business side of things is indeed working very well, and I'm kind of glad in some ways that this case took 3 years to resolve because it kind of proves that point. And maybe we'll hear a little more about the business side of things.
Thank you. Our final speaker will be Daniel Blackman from Howcast, and he's going to set up his slides.
Okay, so full disclosure, I'm probably the only non-lawyer in the room, other than the bartender. Another one over there. I think having spent the last 4 or 5 years working in online video, having spent some time at YouTube and Google, and also being a content provider myself right now in our current business, I hope to offer some perspective. I think the other part of this is what Michael ended up with. I think we're spending a lot of time, hopefully we'll get into this in the discussion, on some of the details of the case as opposed to the implications of the case in the event it goes one way or the other to other young companies, to the business at large. So I think that's something to keep in mind. So to me, from a content provider standpoint, it comes down to this, right? Trying to maintain or build a business that is going against consumer behavior is just not a recipe for success, right? But building one alternatively that feeds on that behavior, I think provides a lot of success, not only for the platform that's where the users are visiting, but also for the content providers that are providing the content. And that's really key. I know Napster is sort of beaten to death, but it is still a cautionary tale, especially right now as we are moving into video. Had the record companies chosen not to shut it down and instead co-opt it, it would have been a very, very different story for the record industry. And I think if you look at the revenues in 1999, recorded music was $40 billion. Last year, it was $17 billion. And that includes Apple, which is the largest retailer, physical or not, on the planet. So this is inclusive of digital downloads, which is growing tremendously. And it's still falling, and there's no end in sight, right? So, I think that's very important from a business perspective. Now, the best definition for Napster, and this is something that's sort of an aside that I think helps frame this if you're that industry, came from one of the executives I used to work with at News Corp, and she said this, right? And it's absolutely true. And the same is true for video right now. I mean, it's these distribution systems are as seamless and as fluid as anything can possibly be with respect to getting your content seen and out there. And now it's video. Right? So the technology is making it possible for users to connect to any video they want at any time from any device. So consider this for a moment. This is a major, major statistic, right? Most people don't think of YouTube as a search engine, but it is now the second largest search engine next to Google, which means that people are going to YouTube to search for everything. And they expect to find everything in video form. And that number is growing. So they're doing 2 billion searches a day, right? So in my mind, and from, I think, lots of different content providers' minds, If you remove your content from Google, if you remove your content from YouTube, it's tantamount to preventing your site being searched by Google. It's just not a smart business decision. Now, the company I work at is called Howcast, and we make all sorts of instructional videos, how-to videos from how to pitch a tent to how to make a margarita to how to prevent an alien abduction. We've seen great interest in consumers viewing our content, not only on our site, but on all the different places that we distribute, which includes YouTube. They're one of our distribution partners. They're our largest distribution partners. And not only is there high consumption there, but we also benefit greatly from a financial perspective, where they have many, many more millions of viewers than we do. We're a young company. So they are a very important partner of ours. And the main takeaway here, and this is what, when I was at Google and YouTube, and I was spending all my time working with the big media companies, Viacom included, we were preaching this. Distribution and destination is the recipe, right? You cannot today run your business if you're only thinking about driving people to your world. That's just completely counter to user behavior. And if you try to do that, you will not succeed. You might succeed to a certain extent, but you will not be serving your customers and your viewers to the extent that they want. Good example of a company that is doing the right thing in this space is Netflix, right? So the rapid explosion of subscriber growth in Netflix is a direct relationship to its content and its service being available everywhere, right? I pay for my $8 a month for Netflix. I can watch that video on my iPad, on my iPhone, on my Wii, on my PS3, and on the web. And not only that, if I pause that video halfway through on one of those devices, it actually picks up at that same point in one of the other devices. Great, great system, very user-friendly, consumer-focused, and I think that's something that all content providers and media companies should look at as an interesting model. And Netflix is growing enormously because of it. They're listening to their consumers, they're providing great technology, and they're innovating. So that behavior is essentially what I'd like to call self-programming. Right? Consumers now are programming their own media experiences. Right? They're not waiting for that show to be on at a certain time. It's an on-demand universe, we all know that. And it's simply what the consumers want. And that's going back to the first slide. You cannot go against the consumers, at least from my point of view and being a young startup. And it's this type of consumption which is driving a huge amount of the innovation that is happening, that we're seeing, both from a technology standpoint and a media and content standpoint. But none of this is possible if the rights holders work to shut down rather than empower these distribution platforms, especially those with such massive reach as YouTube. Programming for this new direction of consumer behavior obviously creates challenges. There's a lot of passion on both sides of the V. But rather than trying to litigate these platforms out of existence, if there are ways to partner with them, then the pie will invariably grow bigger for everybody. I mean, just look at the music industry as a cautionary tale. So in closing, you know, those of us who are on the business side of this trying to craft these new models are best served by trying to partner with these folks than trying to follow the downward spiral of the music business. And that's, you know, what we think is the right way to go, and it certainly has been a benefit from a content provider standpoint to really partner with the YouTube as opposed to try to figure out how to police our content on there. And to Michael's point, their system for recognizing infringing copyright works really well, and the real benefit is that once it's recognized as a piece of content that's been infringing, that copyright holder has the option to let it go up and claim that. So in essence, they're leveraging the digitization and the distribution of individuals to help build their business. So it's even there's another benefit there that transcends the pure technology. But that's my world. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. This has been just wonderful. So as the first question, I'd like to ask you about some of the other dogs in this fight, specifically the ones that didn't bark. I'd like you to talk about, from my perspective, for example, one of the things I was paying close attention to during the litigation was YouTube's content identification system, making it easier for copyright owners to be told about new uploads of material that resembled ones they'd already filed notices on, helping them to monetize it. And I don't know, a number of observers expected that the litigation might evaluate the effects of that for claims of copyright infringement by service providers. And in fact, that played almost no role in the decision of the case. So I'd like to ask you all what you think the most interesting issues that have been put aside for another day by this case are, or perhaps for another court.
Well, let's see. Let me start, and I'm going to address a few of the comments that were made because I think they actually raise issues that were not addressed in the district court opinion that are important. And the first one is, in general, the role of filtering, and that and what's viewed as YouTube's now successful filtering technology. Now. And it is absolutely right that Viacom is not challenging YouTube's practices after May 2008 when this filtering became generally available. But I think the implications of that are exactly the opposite of what has been presented so far. Because, first of all, you know, YouTube could have done that throughout. And, in fact, what it did for a while was say, well, we'll make it available, but only if you give us a favorable license. That's the only way we'll take action so that they're to guard against the theft of copyrighted content. And it was only after considerable discussion, the threat of litigation, and so on, that the filtering was made available, was made generally available. The district court decision removes incentives for that kind of cooperation that everybody agrees is good and appropriate. Because, again, in the district court's regime, all you have to do is respond to the DMCA-compliant notices. If you give actual knowledge and red flags independent meaning, then it creates incentives for everybody to work together, and especially with these large sites, second-largest search engine, which are in a far better position to take effective actions. And just very briefly, two other points. The Netflix model was mentioned. Okay, the implication of the district court opinion is that Netflix, an entity that carefully respects rights holders, is disadvantaged compared to an entity that comes along and says, wait a minute, we don't have to do it the Netflix way. Let's just get a lot of stolen content and, you know, have users post it, and we'll respond to the DMCA notice. That's all we have to do. We can have 80% of it copyrighted content build a great audience. So it puts the Netflix companies, the ones that respect rights, at a very severe competitive disadvantage. And third, the Tiffany case was mentioned and is discussed in the district court opinion. And a dog that doesn't bark in the discussion on the Tiffany case is that the Tiffany case went to trial. Those were findings of fact. That was not a summary judgment issue. There were very careful, explicit findings of fact about eBay's practices, exactly what there's not in this case.
Dogs that don't bark in eBay. I guess one thing that hit me was that, like I said, it was a very well litigated case by the parties, and they had really raised it in considerable detail. One of the challenges with the safe harbors is they date from 1998. And a platform like YouTube is now engaged in very complicated efforts to basically port content across multiple platforms onto mobile phones, onto eventually more types of devices. And they had really set up there were some interesting questions about, to what extent is that type of content, when you're actually basically selling out somebody else's stuff to another platform operator, how do the safe harbors relate to that? The issue just doesn't get really addressed or resolved in a district court opinion. So I will go ahead and put a halt there. But there are some other comments have been made I'd like to respond to, but we'll keep it going.
So I think one of the interesting things that didn't come up in the decision it's alluded to, but Judge Stanton felt no need to get into it, is what exactly this financial benefit directly attributable to infringing conduct means. So that provision, you have to, if you do two things, then you're in trouble. If you have a direct financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing conduct, plus you have the right and ability to control. And Judge Stanton, along with every judge who has walked into this provision, decided on the right and ability to control piece of it. But the interesting question is, what exactly is a direct financial benefit? So a financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing conduct. When is it directly attributable to the infringing conduct? And the question that comes up and that he alludes to is, he says, this is on page 25 of the opinion, 25-26, there may be arguments whether revenue from advertising applied equally to space, regardless of whether its contents are or are not infringing, are directly attributable to infringements. And I think that's the key question, is if you have revenue that is coming in by some means that is what I like to call non-discriminatory, it doesn't hinge on the fact that material is infringing, is that going to be a problem? And if you look at the legislative history, there's some tantalizing statements about sorts of revenue that you can receive that's related to infringing conduct that is not going to cause a problem. You can receive a monthly fee. You can receive a fee based on minutes connected. So that means somebody who is connected for more minutes because they're watching lots of infringing conduct, you're making more money, but that's okay. You can have a per byte charge so that the more traffic that is going through the system, whether that's infringing or not, you make more money. So every time someone watches an infringing clip, you can actually say how much money you made, because you can count the bytes, and that's okay. So I think that there are some, like I said, tantalizing statements in the legislative history suggesting that that sort of non-discriminatory revenue is not a problem, in which case we never need to worry about what right and ability to control means. So I think that's a – I don't know if there's a need to address it, but I think that's one of the interesting issues that wasn't addressed.
One correction. I mean, I don't think it's entirely accurate to say that all the other provisions or courts that have looked at this issue have concluded that right and ability to control requires specific knowledge. That is a legal term of art. It was invented by judges defining the law of vicarious liability for copyright infringement, and it was language that judges developed to communicate to other judges the idea that no knowledge requirement, specific or general, was required for vicarious liability to attach. So Judge Stanton has held that Congress in the DMCA took language that judges developed to convey to other judges the idea that there was no knowledge, general or specific knowledge requirement required for vicarious liability, and used that very language to tell judges that Congress wanted to impose a specific knowledge requirement. That is a ridiculous interpretation of the statute. It violates all known principles of statutory interpretation. It will not stand.
Actually, all I said was that all the courts have addressed it has decided that provision based on right and ability to control. It's true. They've all had different formulations of it. That said, they've all had formulations that would reach the same conclusion here. There's the right and ability to control has very regularly been held to require something more than just the mere right and ability to control your system, which, of course, you have to have if you're going to claim 512C protection in the first place.
I think I'd like to give Daniel a chance to respond to the question, and then we'll go to the audience.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think I'm qualified to have an opinion on that part of the opinion.
Okay, then. Let's take some questions from the audience, and let me say, since we are being recorded, by asking a question, you'll be giving a license to use it in the video that we're making of this. Thank you.
Which will go where?
YouTube.
Right.
Yes.
Were there any claims in this case against the investors or the founders or the management?
And the question was, were there any claims against the investors, founders, or management?
No.
Daniel, thank you for your bravery.
Yeah.
Two-part exactly. question. One is, when you partner with YouTube, are you paid a partnership fee or a revenue share? And if not, are you just giving them your content for free?
Both scenarios exist. There is a partnership program of which we are currently part of, where you do have a revenue share. So both those modes are available to an individual could be a partner, or a business could be a partner.
Others? Yes, there, in the middle.
Michael, are you suggesting that if you creatively design your revenue streaming, you can get away from all liability and have some knowledge?
No. So the knowledge requirement is a separate way to get disqualified from the safe harbor. So if you have actual knowledge, you're out. If you have right and ability control plus a direct financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing conduct, you're out. Those are separate ways to lose the safe harbor protection.
So actual knowledge and still take down survives.
Pardon me?
You're saying that the actual knowledge requirement survives and the takedown provision survives. It's just sort of the middle pieces.
So, yeah, there's several ways that you can lose the safe harbor. There's actual knowledge, there's red flag awareness, there's failure to have a DMCA agent, there's right and ability control and financial benefit directly attributable to infringed conduct, there's failure to respond to takedown notices. So there's a number of ways that act independently to potentially deprive you of safe harbor protection.
Can I ask a question just as a follow-up on that? For actual knowledge and red flags, what, besides a DMCA notice, in your view, would qualify as actual knowledge or red flags knowledge?
Yeah, all I'm going to say is that it does have to be specific to the actual clip, and that if it's going to come from the copyright owner, there are some restrictions on what it can be. If you have something less than a fully compliant notice from the copyright owner, that's ignored, and that's straight in the statute.
No. I'm saying what constitutes actual knowledge and red flags. I mean, you've said, for example, specific knowledge, but it doesn't have to be a DMCA-compliant notice. But as you know, for example, there was an email to YouTube's board that said, as of today, episodes and clips of the following well-known shows can still be found, Family Guy, South Park, MTV, Cribs, etc. And talks about the fact that this is copyrighted content and that there's no authorization for it. So is that... Would that qualify as actual knowledge or red flags?
I have no idea how they know that there was no authorization for that stuff. So, I mean, you have examples, like I said, of efforts by the copyright owners directly to get material up on the system and to do it in a way that made it look as much as possible that it was not actually them putting it up there.
This is my question. So how about – so when YouTube is about to be sold – Credit Suisse, agent of the parties involved, conducts a site survey for purposes of figuring out what content is up and how valuable is it. In other words, for essentially to establish the economic value of the piracy on YouTube at the time, does that trigger? Does that count as a red flag?
So first, I don't think there's anything in the record anywhere that establishes that the reason this work was done was to establish the value of the piracy. I mean, that's
I
just
think
preposterous.
We're getting but, back into your argument
but,
again. So,
but I mean, it's just totally baseless. But the other point is, this is off quoted, and what they actually said was that based on some analysis, and the exact details how the analysis was done, how these were selected, it's totally unclear to me. But They concluded that 60% of this selection of URLs, or 55, I don't remember the exact number.
53, I think, is the number.
So some percentage of these were copyrighted content. Actually, I think they used the word premium content, or removed. So, I mean, that's kind of a curious lumping, I thought. And removed could be removed for any number of reasons. Remember, there's also a bunch of community guidelines for why things should be removed. There's actually the takedown and notice and takedown system, which is exactly what they're supposed to do. Then they're supposed to take these things down. It's entirely unclear exactly what percentage of that material is something that anyone can complain about.
Okay, let's go back to the audience for more questions about the implications of the ruling. Yes.
Thank you. So today we know that a lot of companies use filtering mechanisms and they invest a lot of money in developing and implementing them. And the question is, Why do you think they do it? Is it because they fear liability under 512 C, A, or B, or under Grokster, or is it because they have some financial or any other incentive to use the filtering mechanism, something like Michael touched before?
Let's start with Daniel, who's right. the most businessy of the people here.
The primary reason that this was developed, and as Michael correctly pointed out, is that it's beneficial to all business relationships within the company. So while at YouTube and Google, we were actively trying to partner with the big media companies, and having this type of system made those conversations a lot easier, both for the obvious reasons and also for the reason I alluded to it before, which is if you have the masses of people out there digitizing and finding the clips of interest to them, they're doing a whole bunch of work for you, right? Not only are they identifying the best moments of your content, but they're also uploading them and digitizing them, which is, you know, not a trivial matter, right? I mean, it's become much easier, but it still takes time for someone to do that. And most often, they're not doing it for any other financial gain other than, hey, I love this content, I want to share it. So there is a big benefit from a business development standpoint in those conversations, but also from an operational standpoint, because at the end of that identification, and the system at YouTube was called Claim Your Content, you could then claim that content as yours. The ownership of that content from an uploader standpoint was transferred to you, and now you can monetize it, right? So it's a great operational system. It's good for business development conversations, and it generates more revenue for both parties.
The other thing that's important to keep in mind on all this is over time. Also, remember that you know. Business interests change too. So, for example, if you're an internet access provider, maybe a few years ago, I think Larry Lessig in his book calls fostering piracy the crack cocaine of broadband deployment. Maybe back then it was a good thing, but as you start to roll out, say, an IPTV service, boy, maybe it's not, you know, maybe rampant internet infringement is not such a good thing anymore. So, you know, I think one of the things that I'm hopeful as we go forward is that we will begin to see more of aligning of interests with, you know, technology and content companies. And I think the growth in filtering is an example of that.
So I'm afraid we're coming up at the end of our time, so let's have one last quick question. Yeah.
Mr. Sloan, I'd be curious to know if you would advocate rolling back Sony Betamax.
No, and nor do I think that's implicated here at all.
Just in terms of, you mentioned that YouTube may have been infringing 75-80% of its content, which means 20-25% was not. Do you feel substantial non-infringing?
Sure. I think basically the difference between Sony and YouTube here is the difference between Sony and Grokster. And I think that for the same reason, some people were making exactly the same arguments about Grokster at the time, and the Supreme Court had absolutely no problem saying, no, this is a very, very different situation from Grokster. This is building a business model on infringement, and that's exactly what we have here.
The trick with Sony too is right now, I would have the same answer, and we really don't know what it means anymore in the aftermath of the Grokster case. Views on what the decision says, you know, widely disparate, and the Supreme Court just didn't resolve them. So, you know, the question in my mind is not do we repeal or roll back Sony, but you know, when will we ever get an idea what it actually means?
But I think it's a clearly very different situation.
Yeah. I'm glad that we're all at least able to close by agreeing that Sony is a great decision.
Right.
I think I don't think
we agree.
A great decision in terms of providing work for many of us, figuring out and explaining what it means. Thank you all.
That we can all agree on.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun. Yeah.